Well, I'll say I'm ready.
Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. Today is Wednesday, April 28th. We have four public hearings today, and I'll repeat this again in a minute. We have 18 people signed up to testify today, so that's fine. Very pleased to see the participation today. Before we start our public hearings, would you please call the roll?
Representative Levy.
Present by video.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith.
Excused.
Representative Valderrama.
Present by phone.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Present by video. Thank you. Committee members are present and we're expecting Representative Smith. I would ask now that everybody who has signed up to testify, who's coming into the room, to please have your cameras off and mics off until you're called on to testify. And then please do remember to turn on your camera if you have one and to turn on the microphone. Let's see, Representative Reschke, did you have your hand up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did, and it was to remind you to say what you just said, so I took it down. Oh. Well done.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I want to double check. I'm looking to see if we have any legislators here to testify on their bills. Someone please let me know. I don't see any right at the moment. I believe that's still the case. So we will have a public hearing first on House Bill 2454, and I believe we will probably have the other public hearings in the order in which the agenda is published. But we may play that by ear a little bit if a legislator joins us who's also on a time schedule with another committee and other business. I'm opening the public hearing now on House Bill 2454. Legislative Revenue Office.
Pardon me, can you hear me now?
Yes.
I'm so sorry. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is Jamie McGovern from the Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 2454 is relatively short. It just extends the sunset of the Senior Deferral Program, where the Department of Revenue pays the property taxes on behalf of the homeowners till the tax year starting in 2028. So that would be the first year which properties would not be eligible for that.
Committee members, any questions for LRO? Okay, let's start with the public testimony. We have a witness list with two people signed up to testify. And Manny, I want to confirm with you that there was no other sign up at the last minute, that it's still just two on this bill.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you. First, I'm calling on Sage Shiratori.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, committee members, Sage Shiratori, Oregon Department of Revenue Property Tax Division, and just real happy to testify in support of House Bill 2454. Since 1963, the Oregon Senior and Disabled Citizen Property Tax Deferral Program has allowed low-income participants to stay in their homes. And against the backdrop of the current housing crisis in Oregon, the nearly 5,000 active participants in the program could benefit from the stability and predictability of a sunset extension and seeing the program continue. And that predictability would also benefit the Department of Revenue and local governments as well. So I would note that we have also requested Senate Bill 118, which also extends the sunset and includes a few program enhancements, such as allowing a surviving spouse or disabled heir of a deceased participant to stay in the home without meeting a five-year ownership and occupancy requirement. And you'll also find that provision in a Senate Bill 709 and a House Bill 2634. By the way, there is also a Senate Bill 18 and a Senate Bill 140, which are identical to a bill that we supported along with Senator then Representative Finley in 2019. So the common theme here is that all of these bills extend the sunset and provide that that predictability that is taxpayer friendly. So happy to ask for your support of House Bill 2454 and happy to answer questions if you have any.
Mr. Sciarratore, would you please repeat in the first two bills that you said, oh, this is also like I got Senate Bill 118 and after that House Bill 2634, but what there are like five bills now.
So yes. Yeah, Chair Nathanson, there are a few. So, yes, so 118, 709 and 2634 all contain the provision for the surviving spouse and disabled heir. 118 has a couple of additional provisions. And then also related, but more related to the 2019 bill, is Senate Bill 18 and Senate Bill 140, which are almost identical to each other.
Got it. Thank you very much. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. A quick story and then a question. I had a situation come up a couple of months ago where someone in my community, it turned out, was one of those who had their manufactured homes burned down in September 2020 and had it in the senior deferral program. And her question to me was, I know that I owe this debt, I get that, but what can I do to make them stop piling on interest? And I thought, That's a heavy burden if you owe back property taxes on a manufactured home that's been destroyed. So I reached out to Seiji and he told me the process, and I directed my constituent into that process. And actually, this is reminding me I need to follow up and see if it worked for her to be able to get free of the debt, so that there is, if you can validate in this case. Because there's no land associated with it. There is nothing left to sell to satisfy the property tax debt. So there is a process that the department laid out, a couple of different pathways, actually, to get that off the rolls and off the debt and out of your life. My question is, and so number one, I was very grateful to Sage for the help in laying that out and the pathway to assist this constituent. But it also prompts a question with no particular idea in mind of whether there's anything that we should do to make the process that's set out there easier or more well understood to people who have gone through a similar experience. She did not have any, now clearly she hadn't asked the questions yet, but she didn't, until I intercepted her social media post, basically, she had no idea that she could get out of the probably $4,000 worth of debt that was on her destroyed vehicle.
Yeah, Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, actually without, I was watching that particular case and it looks like that's heading to be a good news story, particularly for those taxpayers who are personal property owners, that the manufactured home and they don't own the land. There are, as you mentioned, a couple of methods, one through the county assessor and one through the department directly, to just contact us and then we'll begin a dialogue of verifying that there's been a destruction or a loss, and there are ways to resolve that.
So my follow-up question is that system as easy as it should be? Is there anything that we should think about if we're tearing up the program? Is there anything that we should address there, or are you satisfied that it works fine?
Yeah, Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh. It seems to work well. Maybe we could do more in terms of publicizing it in the particular instance of the September 2020 wildfires. But in general, taxpayers who have this issue can just contact the department or the county assessor, and it, it seems to run pretty smoothly.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for your help with that.
Happy to help.
The next witness will be Mark Garst, and I will ask Mr. Garst and for everyone testifying on the subsequent bills, we will have plenty of time to hear from everybody who has signed up to testify on all the bills today. If each of you can try to keep your comments within about 3 minutes, then that will allow time for everyone to speak and then the question or two that may come up also. So, Mr. Garst.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. Mark Garst with the League of Oregon Cities. The League supports House Bill 2454, which would extend the sunset for the property tax deferral program for disabled and senior citizens. This deferral program is a lifeline for our thousands of senior and disabled residents who may otherwise not be able to stay in their homes, but for the program. While participation has dropped somewhat in recent years, we think that's maybe likely due to really low mortgage interest rates for conventional mortgages. This program still really meets a need for a lot of folks who maybe are unable to qualify for those mortgages with those super low rates. With the, you know, with the demographics as they are, and demographers talk about a silver tsunami that's coming where a lot of baby boomers are going to be kind of reaching an age where they'd be eligible for this program, we think that this program is going to see a lot of use in the future. I did testify back in February in support of House Bill 2634, which Seiji just described. That bill allows a disabled heir or surviving spouse to pick up where someone who's deceased basically left off, despite the fact that they may not have been in the home for 5 years. We think that that's also a great policy and would love to see that happen. Since that hearing, I have worked with Representative Drazen to also incorporate an amendment that includes both those changes and the sunset extension, and then also the provisions of Senate Bill 18, which is Senator Finley's bill, which is basically identical to what passed this committee back in 2019, went through the House with only, I think, maybe two nay votes, and then got hung up in the Senate Finance and Revenue on a timing issue. So that's, you know, a policy that would, one, allow late filing. Currently, property tax folks have to apply for this program by April 15th, but it would allow an extension to December 1st so that when people get that tax bill in October, they might be able to apply for the program. And then secondly, it sets a $250,000 threshold that any home in Oregon would be able to qualify for the program if they are less than $250,000. Currently, it's a county by county basis, and it depends on how long you've been in the house. And so for an example, in Washington County, if you were in the home for more than 25 years, a $1 million home could qualify to be in the senior deferral program. Whereas in Wheeler, and I'm using the extremes here, in Wheeler, you might be in a house that's worth $153,000, and you've been there for 25 years, and the department would have to say, no, your home's too valuable to participate in this program. So it would set a threshold of $250,000 that would be a new minimum. Anything below that would be allowed into the program, regardless of what county it's in, and this would mostly hit rural counties. Right now, this program is strong. We're bringing in more money every year than we are putting out in tax payments, and I think that now is the time that it might make sense to ease a little bit of the requirements. We don't want to go too far. We all remember what happened when this fund was insolvent at one time, but I think we might want to go a little ways towards allowing access to the program. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Garst? Okay, before I close the public hearing, LRO, do you have some comments or observations for us before we close this public hearing?
No, Chair Nathanson, I'm happy to be a resource. I'll also just remind the committee that we do have a section on the senior deferral in our basic facts that we publish annually.
Thank you. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. McGovern, would it be possible to just build a quick spreadsheet with the four or five bills that were mentioned today on this topic and list out kind of the features of each. So we have the just the extension of the sunset, and we also have then extending to a surviving spouse. And then there was a couple of other features, just so I could take a look at a glance and we kind of see from a tax policy perspective, what bill does what and what's the best vehicle to move forward.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. That does it for House Bill 2454. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2454. I believe that one of our fellow legislators has joined us. Is Representative Bossart Davis in the room?
Yes, I am, Chair Nathanson.
Okay, I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2247, Legislative Revenue Office.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, this is Jamie McGovern again from Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 2247A would authorize the county to adopt an ordinance or resolution authorizing the waiver of interest charge for failure to pay taxes. Excuse me, when due, and this specifically would apply to the 2020-2021 property tax year for businesses, and then there's also criteria set up in there that would be required under the ordinance to demonstrate that failure to pay taxes was due to COVID-specific circumstances.
Thank you. Committee members, any questions for LRO before we move to the public comments? Okay, Representative Bossart Davis.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shelley Bossart Davis. I'm the state representative from House District 15. I introduced House Bill 2247 at the request of my Linn County Board of Commissioners as a response to what they are seeing on the ground in Linn County. HB 2247 allows the county commission to adopt an ordinance to waive interest and penalties on delinquent property taxes if it can be shown that delinquent property taxes are substantially due to the effects of the pandemic or 2020 wildfires. While HB 2247 was in the House Committee on Wildfire Recovery, we convened a technical work group based on feedback of the committee and stakeholders. The work group was able to fine-tune an amendment that still accomplishes the original goal. I'm happy to say we are successful getting the Dash 1 amendment adopted, and HB 2247A passed unanimously out of the House Special Committee on Wildfire Recovery. If it pleases the chair, I will now turn it over to JL Wilson, who is on for a more comprehensive review and also to answer any questions so that I may go back to my committee.
Representative Bossart Davis, thank you for being with us. And before I start calling on the others, I need to check on the availability of one of the witnesses who had a timing issue. But thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Chancellor, I'm going to ask if you are still here and if you can stay with us for another 3 or 4 minutes while I call on someone else first.
Madam Chair, I was able to get back in time from picking my daughter up for school, so my pleasure.
Okay, thank you. I would like to now call on JL Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. For the record, I'm JL Wilson representing Linn County in support of House Bill 2247. I think this bill was born from a county commission that did not want to add insult to injury for businesses or their small businesses that may have been delinquent in property taxes and also charge them additional interest. Under Oregon law, taxpayers are charged 16% annual interest on delinquent filings. And what this bill does is that it gives the county commission discretion to cancel the interest owed on delinquent filings just for the 2020-2021 tax year, July 1, 2020 through June 30th of 2021. High level points, the bill is permissive County commissions can either adopt this ordinance or they can choose not to. And it's temporary. As I mentioned, it references just one tax year from July 20 to through June of 2021. Some other points of interest of the bill, it only applies to interest imposed under the law. All references to penalties are deleted. So the bill is refined just to allow the county to remove interest payments. No penalties are affected. The bill only applies to real property. As you know, a business will often have real property and personal property. This is just impacting the real property tax, which is the land and the building. It only applies to one tax year beginning on July 1 of 2020. It only applies to property owners that are current on their property taxes as of February 15th, 2020. And the reason this was amended into the bill, of course, was to ensure that people that are habitually delinquent are precluded from getting this benefit if affected. And so one of the prerequisites is that a taxpayer be current as of February 15th, 2020. It gives the County Board of Commissioners responsibility for considering the applications. It defines substantially due. So this is a taxpayer has to prove that this delinquency is substantially due to COVID or a wildfire through some criteria listed in the bill. That the primary among them is that the property owner was subject to a shutdown order authorized by a COVID-19 emergency declaration, or that 25% of the owner's lease income under contract is in arrears, or that the 2020 business revenue in any quarter is 25% less than an equivalent quarter in 2019. And the reason this provision was added because it's the same as the PPP requirements when you apply to the federal government for a PPP loan. It also had application to wildfire, and that is if there was a reduction in value due to wildfire based on the criteria set by the commissioners. The last thing I'll mention is that it just provides that the interest is waived only when the property taxes are actually paid and that account is made whole. So those are the specifics of the bill. They were ironed out in a work group. And at this point, I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Next, I'm calling on Tyler Jansen.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tyler Jansen. I'm here today on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties in support of House Bill 2247A with the -2 amendment. JL did a great job of running through all of the different provisions and criteria that are included within the bill. I also really want to thank Representative Bossart Davis for convening that work group on short notice and getting some of those concerns ironed out. To go over the high-level points, I'll just hit them quickly. It's permissive. It's another tool that your local governments could use to provide some very, very targeted relief. That criteria is clear and extensive, and there's an extra backstop where those applications have to go to the Board of Commissioners. So AOC's here in support. I want to thank the commissioners out of Linn County, specifically Commissioner Nyquist, who brought this to AOC. I'm pleased to say that our steering committee process supported this unanimously. Thanks so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Eric Kanzler, you're next, and followed by Mark Garst.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Kanzler representing county tax collectors and assessors. And I will be very brief since JL did an excellent explanation of the bill, as Tyler mentioned. This is one of those bills that came in as a concept that required some refinement. I think, as we all know, drafting property tax bills can be a difficult process to get all of the policy and administrative details right. I want to thank Representative Bossart Davis, Commissioner Nyquist in particular, JL, all the other participants, and also Linn County Assessor and Tax Collector Andy Stevens. There was a very effective group. We took a concept in policy, we cleaned it up, we offered discrete, clear, objective administrative terms, and are very pleased with the outcome. As you know, we don't take policy positions on bills, so technically we're neutral, but I just want to say that this process was a pleasure, and we're very pleased with the outcome, so thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I have a question for either you, Mr. Chancellor, or for Mr. Wilson. You've referred to a work group. It seems like the work group worked very effectively. Could you give us an idea of the kinds of organizations or agencies that were included in the work group?
JL, would you like to take a crack at that, or Representative Vossard Davis?
Yes, no problem. Chair Nathanson, we just convened impacted parties. So that would have been the Department of Revenue, the assessors and tax collectors, AOC, and there might have been another. I know at with LOC came in sort of at the end just to make sure that they were okay. But people that had sort of a nexus with this policy were drawn in.
Thank you. Appreciate the response. Next is Mark Garst.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the League of Oregon Cities. LOC supports House Bill 2247 as amended. As you can imagine, we are big fans of timely payment of property taxes, and generally we are not in favor of waiving interest. This is our number one source of revenue, and we really count on timely payments. That being said, we're not looking to profit off of unfortunate circumstances or the misery of taxpayers, and this delinquent interest was never anything that we were counting on in our budgeting. We certainly had concerns with the base bill, but as amended, it limits it to 1 year of tax, and to folks who were current before the COVID incident or before the fire wildfires of 2020. And we feel like that is a sufficient sideboard that it would not incentivize folks to not pay timely going forward. So we're satisfied with the bill as drafted. Thank you.
And thank you for your testimony. That completes everyone who was on the witness registration list that I have. I want to confirm, Manny, there was no additional name that I had after these five.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Committee members, any questions for the people who've been presenting the testimony just now? And LRO, any comments about this before I close the public hearing?
No, Madam Chair, thank you.
All right, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2247. Before I open the next public hearing, I'd like to take a minute to see who's in the room with us. Do we have any other legislators in the room who are signed up to testify? I'm especially looking for Representative Drazen. Is Representative Drazen with us yet?
I'm not seeing her, Madam Chair. We can reach out to her office. Okay, go ahead, Vice Chair.
I'll go ahead and ping her office real quick.
Well, I could move to the other bill if that would be.
Why don't you do that? And that'll give me time. Sounds good.
That's good. Thank you. I'm opening a public hearing now on House Bill 2343A. LRO.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Again, this is Jamie McGovern for the Legislative Revenue Office. This bill deals with enterprise zones, and so it is permissive, but it would authorize the governing body of an enterprise zone sponsor to adopt a resolution to suspend enterprise zone employment requirements that would otherwise be imposed on authorized business firms. So this, in effect, would mean that for property tax years beginning on July 1st, 2021, July 1st, 2022, the normal conditions that are required for property tax exemptions under enterprise zone may be waived or altered by ordinance. And then in the bill, they're set up some of the criteria that would be required in place of the employment considerations that are normally in enterprise zone requirements.
Committee, any questions for LRO before we move to the witness list? We have five people signed up to testify on this one, and I want to say thank you very much to everyone who's already testified for keeping your comments succinct. We will most assuredly have time to hear all of our bills today. I'm going to tell you the order that I will call on the witnesses so you can plan ahead. It will be Avery Pickard, followed by Colleen Padilla, Mark Garst, Rocky Dallum, and Katie Tyson. So first is Avery Pickard.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Pham, Vice Chair Reschke, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Avery Pickard. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Economic Development Association. We're the professional group for the economic development community, and our membership includes cities and counties, ports, regional economic development groups, utilities, all actors that participate in economic development, and this past year have worked heavily in response and recovery. I just wanted to briefly mention the original provenance of this effort, which was our members coming together to discuss where they were seeing gaps in economic response. Many are enterprise zone managers and came together to identify what would be become a problem for key anchor employers already participating in the E-Zone program that would become subject to program disqualification and a penalty because of their employment requirements and as a result of COVID. So what we developed with our members was a somewhat narrow and circumscribed bill to provide relief for these traded sector employers such that they would not have to defer investments in recovery and rehiring because of an unforeseen penalty. Our counsel, Rocky Dallum and Mark Garst with LOC have worked in earnest on amendments and are here for technical questions. And I'd like to stop there so that we can hear from some of our economic development members. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next speaker is Colleen Padilla.
Yes, thank you very much. Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, I'm Colleen Padilla. I'm the Executive Director for Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development based in Medford, Oregon. We have been the zone manager since inception. And just a quick fact, since 1997, we have processed 183 enterprise zone applications, which equivalents of about 13,000 jobs and a quite large investment. But today, I just want to urge your support for this House bill that would just give a little bit of help to a few manufacturers and others, hotel developments in our region also that, for no fault of their own, were unable to meet the employment requirement because they were closed or there were delays in manufacturing, all related to the pandemic. So I'm here to support this bill in favor of supporting our businesses in the region. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. Next, Mark Garst.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Mark Arce with the League of Oregon Cities. LOC strongly supports House Bill 2343. Enterprise zone programs are one of the only tools for local governments to support economic development. Local governments will forego some property tax revenues up front in return for jobs for residents and property taxes down the road. Cities feel this is an incredibly valuable program. Often you'll hear our economic development folks say that this is the only tool in their toolbox. Business Oregon is doing a study right now to look at the effectiveness of the program broadly. We expect results maybe later in the year, maybe next year, and we'll look forward to a broad conversation about this program and the benefits to Oregon and any ways that it might be able to be improved. One condition of the existing program is that businesses must increase employment generally by the greater of one job or 10% over their employment level for the year prior to the application for the exemption. They must maintain this increased employment or they'll be disqualified from the program and any tax savings must be repaid. And that includes tax savings from prior years. This bill does two things. It relaxes the current requirements to temporarily suspend enterprise zone exemptions on a company by company basis. Companies would still pay taxes for that year, but not disqualified, and there would be no clawback. Currently, there are requirements in the statute for statewide and county-specific unemployment triggers, and those triggers just have proven to be challenging to meet in a situation where COVID maybe is affecting certain industries differently than other industries, where certain counties maybe are not particularly looking bad compared to the rest of the state, yet at the same time, these traded sector businesses are competing on a national or international level. So that's one option. The second option is that the bill would allow the sponsor to create standards by which the employment requirements can be temporarily waived for companies who have lost employees due to the COVID pandemic, and companies may continue to receive the exemption. Cities, if you talk to city folks about these programs, they will tell you jobs are key. And so we do not take the idea of waiving these jobs lightly. We've worked with some folks who are interested parties at the suggestion of some very intelligent legislators, and I'll say that we've come up with some language that'll come out in an amendment that would kind of tighten up the requirements a little bit so that it's clear that the reason we're doing this is that these companies have been affected by COVID. We've also worked with DOR and the assessors. The timing is going to present some challenges. This bill will not become effective until about the same time that the assessors turn the roll. But through a couple of different mechanisms, we're confident that we have come up with a solution where this can actually work. It would have been ideal if we would have been able to get this done in a special session, but that didn't happen, and we're left with the situation we have now. Business Oregon does some good economic development work, but the state has really stepped away from doing economic development generally since the Betsy debacle. The state does benefit from the enterprise zone program through increased income taxes from these employees, and the state has done a lot of good work related to small businesses during the pandemic, but we really have not seen much in the way of business assistance for larger traded sector businesses. We think that this is a gap, and we ask that you please support this bill to keep this local tool viable. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Garst, I have a question for either you or Ms. Pickard or Ms. Padilla, maybe even for Mr. Dallum to respond to. Several of you now have mentioned traded sector businesses. That's not some of the smaller, what we call Main Street businesses. And as you just mentioned a moment ago, the state has tried to do some types of things to help small businesses. You think it's time to help the traded sector businesses. But could you tell me why the focus is for this particular type of relief to help apparently only traded sector businesses and not others that may happen to be located within an enterprise zone?
Sure, I can take a stab at that unless Avery would like to. Chair Nathanson, I don't know that, you know, we're necessarily looking to exclude small businesses, certainly. I think that it's just the nature of the Enterprise Zone program that a lot of the participants are larger businesses, and that Enterprise Zone program is really focused towards manufacturing. And often when you're a manufacturer, you sell your product not just inside the state of Oregon, but you sell to other folks in other states, or folks in other countries. And that's what we mean by traded sector generally, is that your products have a market that's outside of Oregon. And so I think it's coincidental that that's what this does, the enterprise zone program generally. But I think that those are the types of businesses that will most likely benefit from this. But again, size is not really determinative.
Thank you. The committee is generally aware of the importance of the traded sector businesses, but I will wait to hear others testify and see if other committee members have similar questions. Rocky Dallum is the next person to testify.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. Rocky Dallum, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Economic Development Association. And I think you've largely heard the policy basis for the bill and some of the history of creating the bill. So I, in the interest of time, won't recover that ground. Just want to flag for the committee, this has been a process. It started in 2020 with the economic development professionals and talking about how we would do this. Mr. Garst, I think, has been humble in his characterization of the bill. He spent a lot of time after the policy committee hearing working with the assessors and Department of Revenue to make sure that the bill is implementable, given the challenges in timing between when the property tax year is and when the pandemic and the executive orders first started. So I'll just mention, in light of that, I think the question and the concern that we've had and legislators have expressed both on the record in conversations we've had is ensuring that this is limited and narrowly tailored so that it is only for those employers who did suffer setbacks in their employment numbers due to the pandemic. We had some conversations, I think you're going to hear from AFL-CIO this week, too, to discuss, you know, how to make sure that those criteria are more narrow. And I think the intention from everyone is to make sure that this is available, whether that's a larger a small employer. If you're within that enterprise zone and it was either your supply chains, safety reasons, but your employment numbers drop below those thresholds. Now, hopefully, as time moves on, we have less and less companies who need to avail themselves of the waiver. And of course, that waiver will be within the control of the local government to determine, you know, whether or not they want to issue it during the enterprise zone years. So we urge your support of this bill. I think both Mr. Garst and myself can answer technical questions if you have them about either the payment in lieu process in one section of the bill or the temporary abatement. And I'm not sure if Mr. Kanzler is available to answer questions from the assessors, but we hope this is a narrow product that fixes a challenge and a problem that some have in response to COVID and not any broader than that. So we appreciate all the feedback that we've heard from others and try to incorporate that into the bill.
Thank you. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Rocky, I realize I don't know exactly how the system works if we didn't make this change. So I'm an employer. I've suffered a COVID setback. I can't meet my employment standards. So are my protections suspended or are they terminated under current conditions?
So Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, and Mark, you might want to take a swing at this as well. Typically, you know, outside of the realms of COVID, if an employer doesn't meet the employment requirements that are required in the E-Zone statute or their local agreement, and they drop below those for whatever reason, the zone sponsor then would essentially claw back what they would have owed in property tax. There's enterprise zones can last anywhere from 1 to 5 years, but they're, you know, mostly the 3 to 5 year zone where you have to enter into that agreement. And so in normal times, that property tax liability would be clawed back if you dropped below your employment thresholds. What this bill says is that for this period only, the local government can pass a resolution, set that criteria on, as Mark said, an employer-by-employer basis, and say, okay, you drop below those thresholds for a period of time. We're not going to claw that back, or as the bill structured, you will pay the tax, but I believe it's section 2 is the payment in lieu, right? I'm looking at Mark for a nod. Then you would get that payment returned by the assessor once they actually determine what your assessed value is. So, Mark, you might want to fill that in, but in normal times, yeah, the local government would have the authority and the capability to come back and levy taxes on that expanded investment. And in this situation, it would only be temporarily waived.
And Chair Nathanson and Representative Marsh, you know, I would just add that there is some limited ability for relief under current statute, but there are a number of triggers that you have to hit. You have to have had 2 quarters of declining employment. I think that the county employment levels have to be higher than the statewide average, those sorts of things. And I could get you more information on the specifics. But what we've heard from our economic development folks is that there are businesses that are in counties that are not going to meet that trigger for one reason or another. I mean, if you think about what employment did, it just dropped off a cliff and it's been getting better. Right, but we're still not back to where we were pre-COVID, and some of these businesses have challenges related to, you know, larger markets that, you know, maybe aren't reflected just in Oregon employment numbers. And so it creates a new path to give them relief based off of them demonstrating that they had employment losses that were related to COVID. So, and that's on the suspension. And then also there's a second provision in Section 3, I believe, that would allow, you know, under a suspension, you still pay the taxes, but under this Section 3 provision, you would actually not pay the taxes for this year. And we have some companies that are having some serious cash flow issues right now, and that provision does not exist in current law. And so this would create a path as an option, right? The local could do either or, and it would create a path where they could actually allow the company to not have to pay the taxes for that year. But yeah, Rocky's right. If you get disqualified, you not only pay back your current year taxes, but you pay back any savings that you saw as long as you were in the program. So some of these companies could be looking at bills that are, you know, for 3 or 4 years of taxes. Nobody wants to put one of these companies under. And for the cities, we just see this as a let's not kick folks while they're down kind of bill. So that's where we're coming at it.
Thank you. That was super helpful.
Any other questions before I move to the next witness? The next witness will be Katie Tyson. Oh, sorry, Rep. Smith. I see your hand now.
Thank you. I'm extraordinarily familiar with enterprise zones and how they operate. I actually oversee, I think, 3 of them. One of the questions I would ask, and I guess it's theoretical, and I don't know if our previous witnesses have an answer to this, but when a county and a business enter into an enterprise zone agreement, they both assume a level of risk. The county is assuming that the business is going to succeed and to create employment opportunities. In return, they're willing to set aside property taxes for 3 to 5 years, although you're correct, 1 to 2 years is an option. And in return, the company assumes some risk because they sign a contract saying we will deliver X investment and X number of employees. And in return for their risk that they take, they get to take advantage of not having to pay taxes for 3 to 5 years. And so what House Bill 2343 is saying is as well, one side took some risk and it's not quite working out. And so we want to modify the agreement. And I'm not necessarily opposed to House Bill 2343, but I'd be really interested in hearing businesses' comments on why one side should take a risk and have to honor it, but the other side takes the risk and when it doesn't quite work out, they ask for relief.
I'll take that one, Mark, if you're all right.
Question that needs to be asked.
Yeah, Chair Nathanson, Rep. Smith, and as you raised your hand, Rep. Smith, as you say, you probably have more experience in the mechanics, so if we miss something, you certainly have seen these agreements. As Mark and I've talked about this with a number of stakeholders, I think the term that popped up that's not in the bill is sort of force majeure, and I think that's the business side risk question that a lot of businesses are looking at is a risk that was if not unforeseeable, was unforeseen certainly by both the local governments and the employers going into the pandemic. And I think that speaks to the criteria that we've put in as well as what hopefully you'll see as a new amendment that even lays out that criteria with a little more clarity, which is the only reason to change that agreement based on a risk that the parties didn't foresee is in respect to or in response to the pandemic. And that's If your employment number dropped because you could only have so many employees on the shop floor. I think as we get on the further backside of this pandemic too, we're recognizing that there are employers who are ready to bring their employees back, but with school schedules and others, we've heard stories that, you know, they can't get back to full staff. And so I think part of the answer is you're right. Part of the Enterprise Zone tool is to ensure that if the employer doesn't hold up its end of the bargain, it will be on the hook for those back taxes. But in this circumstance, those circumstances that are out of the control of the employer, which are, hey, we would have put people to work, but either an executive order said we couldn't put them to work, or we couldn't get our raw materials into our manufacturing facility because supply chains were shut down. And so we couldn't have people show up to work, and that became both a cash flow issue and an eligibility issue. So I think it's a good conversation that, as Mark says, we need to have about the Enterprise Zone tool so that we all understand how it works. But I think force majeure is really the applicable standard here, is we have a risk that no one really saw coming in the magnitude and then taking shape the way that it did for these manufacturers.
And Chair Nathanson, may I follow up?
Sure.
And I think that's understandable. I would just point out, though, that counties have a similar situation. I don't see businesses stepping up and doubling their payroll tax in Coos County because their economy has struggled. And so I think we need to be very, very careful about modifying contracts. And when agreements are made and hands are shook, your word is your word. And so I would assume a business, when they enter into these agreements, fully understand that natural disaster, public health crises, acts of God naturally occur, and those are part of the risk you take when you go into business. And I'm not opposed to this, Chair Nathanson. I'd be more than willing to cast an aye vote if it helps, but I really do think this is a conversation that needs to occur. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you, Representative Smith, for, as always, for bringing your perspective to these issues and raising the questions that need to be discussed. I really appreciate it. Representative Pham.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I also appreciate Rep. Smith's comments and wanted to reflect a little bit more. I think I also see some real value in the intention behind this bill. I missed, could LRO share is there an estimated revenue impact on this this change? I think I might have missed it earlier.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Pham, no, we don't have that yet during this public hearing. That's something we'll be working on. I think it's an intertemporal change, so you might see, you know, those businesses that are paying the property taxes now because they're property tax exemption is delayed, so there might be property taxes paid now versus the exemption that they would be getting during this period if the sort of they were qualified and maintaining their qualifications. So there's a lot of things that we have to look at, not just the loss or a gain, but like the intertemporal shifts.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you.
It's also tricky when something is permissive and not mandatory, and the property by property analysis, for example.
Absolutely. Thank you for that clarification.
Any other questions before we get to the next witness? Okay. Now, Katie Tyson, are you still with us?
I am indeed. Thank you, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. Katie Tyson with the Oregon AFL-CIO, which represents 300,000 workers across Oregon and is a voice for all workers in the legislative process. Really appreciate the broader discussion on enterprise zones. I would say, in terms of that broader policy conversation, we appreciate that this policy can be used as a really critical economic development tool. However, we also know that the lost tax revenue is best justified when the minimum qualifications include a requirement for long-term high-paying jobs with family supporting benefits. So to that end, on that broader conversation, we do believe that there should be stronger employment requirements in place when such significant tax abatements are considered, and enforceable standards that allow for accountability when those commitments aren't met in normal times. We also really appreciate the challenges for both workers and employers alike over the last year of the pandemic. And so, you know, as has been said, but just to reiterate, for under the current statute, for the first several years of property tax exemption, the qualification for a property tax abatement is really simply that the business grow their employees by the greater of one new job or 10%. And even sometimes there's some special case local sponsor waivers that lessen that. So, you know, for some of these manufacturing, shipping, and processing employers during COVID-19, we understand that compliance with state and federal safety regulations, like distancing requirements, PPE supply constraints, some of the things that you've been hearing about today, in addition to the decrease in economic demand in some instances, meant that maintaining and growing employees was simply not an option. So in these narrow instances, as the proponents have talked about, we agree with them that paying a property tax bill that they were not anticipating is not necessarily beneficial to workers or the local economy. I will say, probably unsurprisingly, we have significant concerns with the engrossed bill as it's laid out, because it's not nearly as narrow as it needs to be to ensure that only employers actually impacted by COVID or by the pandemic can waive the already minimal employment requirements. So we were able, as Rocky and some other folks have talked about, we were able to work with the proponents of the bill on a forthcoming consensus amendment that will get us to neutral by significantly narrowing and clarifying the bill to ensure that there is an actual need caused by the pandemic to waive the minimum employment requirement. So just to go through this a little bit more, we expect this amendment to outline the ways in which, as Rocky said, the business economic hardship justifies lifting the minimal qualifications for the continuing property tax break. So economic hardship criteria includes compliance with safety measures or closures, limitations on facility capacity, a decrease in receipts or sales that required the employer to lay off employees, a disruption in the firm's access to markets or supply chains, or other bona fide COVID-19 related reasons. And with that, I will just say, let's see. You know, I think the goal of this amendment that we all agree on is that only employers with a true need related to COVID-19 are impacted by this policy. And I think that amendment will hopefully get us a step closer there. The last thing I'll say is, as you're continuing these broader conversations, we really hope that you keep a critical eye on sidebars for any further tax exemptions, and that enterprise zones do what they're supposed to do, which is good jobs for Oregon workers, particularly when unemployment is high.
Thank you, Ms. Tyson. There is a question. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know who can answer this, but I was just thinking about Representative Smith's comments a few moments back about breaking handshakes and contracts and stuff like that. And I just want to make sure we're clear, or I guess I'm asking a clarifying question, is that this doesn't mandate that governments do this. This allows governments to do this and businesses to kind of renegotiate the contract. It just gives them permission to do that. Is that correct, or is there a mandate in here?
Chair Nathanson, if I could take that one.
Yes, and Mr. Garst, let's keep it kind of short, the response.
Certainly. So, Rep. Reschke, yes, this is absolutely a local option for the zone sponsor, and I don't think that you would see the league supporting this bill if it were not. Right now, you have landlords all across the state who are waiving rent for businesses that are in trouble, and we look at that as something good that the landlord's doing. Here you have zone sponsors. They don't have any ability to work with these companies currently, and all this bill does is give them the ability to work with the companies who are having obvious issues that, you know, they hadn't. Really, I don't know how anyone could have expected that this COVID was coming.
Thank you.
And I'd like to follow up on Representative Reschke's question to just also confirm what I believe I heard was adopting the ordinance doesn't adopt a one-size-fits-all renegotiation agreement, that each one will be considered on its merits and there could be different characteristics from one to another. Is that correct?
Yeah, Yeah, Rep. Nathanson, that's right. And just as way of background, that was a question that several folks asked last year when we crafted this, is why not just do a statewide approach? It's much easier to implement. And I think our members from the OEDA perspective were also conscious of that, that it only was used where needed. And so it protects that Enterprise Zone program by showing that we're only going to change it where absolutely necessary. So yeah, even if a local government passes a resolution, that resolution will still only apply to the employers that they decide to change the agreement with, not each of them in the Enterprise Zone.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions for these five witnesses? And LRO, any comments before I close the public hearing on this bill?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm sorry, it's Bob Estabrook from OSEA. I had signed up late on both this and the next bill, and I worry I may have made an error and not been on the list for this bill, but if I could be heard for just 1 minute.
I'm sorry, I can't allow it because we're trying to make sure we follow the rules for everybody. However, I do want to encourage you to submit written comments. We are happy to take written testimony for 24 hours, up to 24 hours beyond when this meeting started. And we will look for you to send something in and read it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
But I do want to confirm also with staff. Staff, did we have the name Estabrook added for 2343? I know I have it added for another bill.
I'll add Bob Estabrook to 2343 soon.
Manny, that wasn't the question. The question is, did Mr. Estabrook sign up for 2343 before the deadline?
No, he did not sign up.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Estabrook, but please do send in your written comments. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2343, and I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2630. We'll start with LRO, and I do want to let everyone know that we have six people signed up to testify, and that does include Mr. Estabrook. Okay, 2630, Legislative Revenue Office.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is Dave Beck, Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 2630 provides that for five school years starting from 2020-2021 school year, the weighted average daily membership of a school district calculated for purposes of distributing state monies to school districts may not decrease from the 1920 school year level. If the district was impacted by wildfires in 2020. Now, these provisions in this measure apply whenever ADMW is calculated for the purpose of distributing state monies to school districts. That includes the distributions of the state school fund and the fund for student success. These provisions are repealed on July 1, 2025. The measure takes effect on its passage. And that's all I have, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Committee, any questions for LRO before we go to our witness list? Okay, the names are, and I'm gonna call them so that you can prepare for the order, Jacob Vandiver, Lane Tompkins, Brent Berry, Morgan Allen, Laurie Wimmer, Bob Estabrook. We'll start with Jacob Vandiver.
Awesome. Thank you. Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Pham and Reschke, members of the committee, lovely to be with you today. My name is Jacob Vanver. I am the legislative director for the House Republican Office, here today to read testimony on Representative Drazen's behalf, who apologizes for not being able to be here right now. The state school fund provides around 80% of general operating dollars for Oregon schools and ESDs. The fund's equalization formula is designed to promote equity and ensure our schools have the funding they need based on the needs of the student population. This formula uses the average daily membership count, which is the aggregate days membership of a school during a certain period, divided by the number of days the school was in session during that same period. Furthermore, the formula provides additional weights for our students in poverty, foster care children, pregnant and parenting students, English language learners, our special education students, neglected and delinquent students, and small school correction students. Added together, these metrics result in the weighted average daily membership. These weights are an important part of our funding formula to ensure that we fund our schools equitably and that our schools have the resources they need, especially in our underserved communities. Last year, the wildfires devastated many communities across our state, leaving too many Oregonians without a home. In Representative Drazen's district, they were impacted by the Riverside Fire as well as the Beachy Creek Fire. Together, these fires burned over 33,000 acres of land. For many children impacted by these wildfires, attending school, even virtually, became impossible. The fiber line that provides internet for the Canby School District and other school districts in the county were destroyed. Internet and power outages in the district left many students without access to virtual learning, even when school resumed. Families rightfully prioritized their health and safety by temporarily moving to other parts of the state, even when evacuation orders were lowered to level one to avoid hazardous smoke and poor air quality. Many of these families didn't have a home to come back to. Families were forced to balance distance learning with living in campgrounds, hotels, and parking lots. Our funding formula does not account for these students, and unfortunately, students that were not able to attend schools during these fires risk not being counted for the purposes of the funding formula. This puts at risk our most vulnerable students in schools from not receiving the funding and resources they desperately need. House Bill 2630 would avoid the funding shortfalls that put our schools impacted by wildfires at risk of underfunding. By allowing impacted schools to use the ADMW for the 2019-2020 school year for the next 5 years, we can avoid penalizing students who, through no fault of their own, were unable to attend schools during last year's wildfires. HB 2630 is an equitable approach to maintaining funding for our schools across Oregon that were impacted by wildfires by not picking and choosing what schools deserve funding and what schools do not. I want to thank the committee very much for their time. I don't know my capacity to answer questions, but I'm happy to get back to you if anybody has one. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And we will look forward to your staying in the room with us as long as you can to listen in case there is a subsequent question. Thank you. Next is Lane Tompkins.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the Revenue Committee. I'm Lane Tompkins, Superintendent Principal of McKenzie School District, come to you today in support of HB 2630. During last September's Holiday Farm fire, nearly a third of our staff and a quarter of our students lost their homes. I commend all the various agencies, federal, state, and local, as well as area nonprofits for their efforts to support our community in our time of need. Looking ahead to the upcoming 21-22 school year, we are already in the budgeting process. The effects of HB 2630 not passing would be nearly $300,000 lost to our district. So that number may not be a big one considering the funding that this committee works with regularly. But to us, that represents the equivalent of about four teachers or nearly a third of our licensed faculty or eight classified staff, about equivalent. Not having the funding for the next 5 years would add even more stress to community and recovery. The five-year timeline would give us time to mindfully plan a reduction should we find our enrollment does not return to pre-fire levels in the next couple of years. Recovery is just starting. Rebuilding is starting. and there has not been, you know, enough time to mindfully know which direction that will go. Like for context, we got an internet back in March in our area, so there's a lot of work yet to be done. But this this bill would give us a little bit of a cushion to be able to be mindful in our next steps. So I wanted to keep my comments brief and give you guys the time back, but I just also want to thank you for all the time and effort that you do for what's best for all of Oregonians. So thank you for your time.
And thank you for your testimony. Next is Brent Berry.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tiffany Lambert, and I'm Assistant Superintendent of Phoenix Talent Schools. And with your permission, I'd like to read Mr. Brent Berry's testimony on his behalf.
That's fine. Would you please just remind me your name? It's Tiffany?
Tiffany Lambert.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm speaking with you today to provide an update on the impact of the Alameda Fire on the community that we serve and the needs of our students, our families, and our community as a whole. For this testimony, I will focus my comments on the impact of ADM in our district and the dire need to remain whole in order to serve our kids and our families. I want to start with the reality for our families. More than 480 families who care for over 700 students in our district lost their homes. Those families have scattered to find support wherever they can. Locally, that means they're now living with one, two, or even three other families at a single residence. Or they may be in an RV or a trailer that was generously donated, or they may still be in hotels. For others, their only available support is found out of the area, meaning a complete uprooting of their family. This is heartbreaking on many levels. We ask for the three districts impacted by the wildfires to remain whole for a five-year period based on the 2019-20 ADM numbers. This will allow our community to support students and families, remain consistent with staffing and programs, and allow for more individualized academic and social-emotional interventions. There is no question, the past year has reiterated the fact that public schools are the centerpiece to communities throughout our region and state. This was never more evident than the hours after the devastating Alameda Fire on September 8th, where we witnessed school personnel provide outreach to fire victims who lost everything. Staff connected with every one of our students and asked questions of basic needs. This support continues every day in helping families navigate housing challenges and providing a safe, enriching learning environment with many engaging programs. In November of 2017, our community invested in the future of this district with the passage of a $68 million bond, and the state-of-the-art facilities are nearly complete. In order for us to continue the support and not allow the Alameda Fire to traumatize our community for a second time by eliminating staff, programs, and school days, ADM security is vital. We understand you have tough decisions you all have to make when it comes to serving all Oregonians, and we thank you for your diligence in this process. For Phoenix Town Schools, ADM security over the next 5 years will allow us to respond, recover, and be fiscally responsive to our reality of the current challenges. Grateful for the opportunity to share on behalf of Brent Berry, Superintendent, Phoenix Talent Schools.
Thank you for bringing the testimony to us. Next is Morgan Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Morgan Allen on behalf of COSA, and my video is working today, so I'm very excited.
Morgan, I'm going to interrupt you for a minute. I think Rep. Marsh had a question.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Actually, I had a comment, but I'm happy to reserve that and not interrupt the flow.
Thank you. Can we do that in just a few minutes?
You bet.
Thanks so much. Morgan Allen.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. Morgan Allen on behalf of COSA, and there's not much more I can say. You just heard from two of our members, Superintendent Tompkins and Tiffany Lambert, on behalf of Superintendent Berry. They laid out the situation quite clear. I do want to thank both Representative Drazen and Representative Marsh for their leadership on this issue. I've had good conversations with both of them this session. This is one of COSA's top legislative priorities this session, is to create a five-year funding floor. You heard from two of the districts, Phoenix Talent in Southern Oregon and McKenzie in Lane County. The other district that was severely impacted is Santiam Canyon, which is located in Marion County. So there's just a couple things, and I mentioned this in previous testimony. As part of the governor's recommended budget, she recommended transferring $5 million into the state school fund to help cover the costs, because right now The way this bill is written, the funding floor would come out of the funding of all the other school districts in Oregon. And we just want to put that on the record that in the budget process, we want to make sure that the funding source is clearly defined, because certainly I know our members don't want these funds to come at the expense of other school districts. And since we have so much federal money and other resources available, we'll be sure to work with the Ways and Means folks to identify a funding process. And then the other thing I'll just also put on the record, I spoke to Todd Miller today, who's the superintendent of the Sandy Canyon School District, and they have a very large virtual charter school. And I just wanted to put on the record that the school districts that have virtual charter schools are not asking for a funding floor for the virtual charter schools. They're asking for a funding floor for their resident students in their brick and mortar schools. And I know ODE is aware of that situation, and we may need to make sure they have enough, that ODE has enough flexibility to, when they're making these calculations in the rulemaking process, to make it very clear that we're talking about resident brick and mortar students in the funding floors. So I would be happy to answer any questions, and we look forward to working with LFO and LRO and the sponsors to get this across the finish line and supporting our districts this session. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Laurie Wimmer.
Yes, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. For your record, Laurie Wimmer representing OEA's 41,000 members, and I'm honored to share some thoughts with respect to the House Bill 2630. First, let me say that we strongly support helping these struggling school districts who've gone through this tragedy. But we also believe that a remedy should come not from other school districts' share of the state school fund, as Mr. Allen just told you. We were originally under the impression that just three school districts whose losses put them in line for support would be eligible for this fix, but we now hear there may be many more. And so our concerns about money are really paramount. As drafted, there are several elements of the bill that are problematic in addition, and we hope that we may be able to offer constructive comments and even help to amend the bill if that's your pleasure. The first one is a data collection problem. The bill assumes inaccurately that school districts collect data on the reasons students exit a district, and it does so on line 6 and 7 when it describes the districts for whom this program would be eligible. And it does so on, again, on line 13 and 14 when it directs the Department of Education to determine if a decrease in average daily membership was as a result of wildfires in 2020. And without a survey of exiting students, the only rule the department could create to assume is to assume that every student who transfers out of these districts was wildfire-related transfers. So we would hope that we could fix the bill in that regard. The second is a confusion between operational funds and grant programs. And we believe that it makes sense to stabilize the operational funds districts receive to run their school districts. And in these wildfire affected areas, that's great for the state school fund, but this bill goes one step further and also extends extra money in the Student Success Act grant. Districts have access to many grants, high school success, federal grant programs, and the student investment account. These are the best knowns, but this bill singles out only the SSA. And the problem with this is that operational dollars flow to support districts generally, and therefore it makes sense to make sure that they are stable in that huge piece of their funding for the 5 years. But the SIA is designed to fund specialized programs over and above operations, and any grant maker says to the applicant, if we give you X dollars, what will you do with it? And every year when they come back for review, they're able to retrofit that grant proposal based on the capacity of the school district in the moment. So we believe that the SSA piece should be taken out. The third is a calculation that includes students residing outside of the wildfire affected districts. As you heard Morgan also say, the bill does not say that it's only for brick and mortar student counts. And rather than wait for rulemaking, my comfort level would be increased if we were clear in the bill that this refers only to those place-based students who were impacted by wildfires and not the 86% of students who are in the Santa Ana Canyon Schools virtual program. So finally, as to funding, we would recommend that the federal relief funds be used to pay for this rather than for it to come out of all the other school districts you all represent. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for the testimony. Next is Bob Estabrook.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Bob Estabrook for the Oregon School Employees Association, representing 23,000 educators from early learning through community colleges across Oregon. I think you've heard from my colleagues, Morgan and Lori, very important details about our thoughts around the bill. I want to be very clear that we fundamentally strongly support having a five-year protection for these affected school districts, not only our members who work there, but obviously for the students and their families. This is critical. We know, I think, even more so in light of the pandemic, how essential schools are as centers of the community, especially in smaller and more rural districts. A five-year protection is really not a very long period of time when we're thinking about long-term planning and thoughtful budgeting. So I think that's appropriate and would echo some of the very narrow and specific concerns that Morgan and Lori have shared as being things that I think are important to clarify in the bill. But we do want to make sure that it is above all else, we want to make sure that there is this protection established for the wildfire affected districts this session so that there is not any loss of peace of mind for the superintendents that you've heard from the staff, the families in these communities who really have enough to worry about without being concerned about their ADMW calculation becoming a problem for them. With that, I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you for your testimony. And Representative Marsh, I want to come back to you. You had your hand up a few minutes ago. You're on, Rep. Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I just wanted to chime in. You heard from the Talent Phoenix School District just a little tiny glimpse into what their lives have been like since September 8th. And I wondered if you would indulge me just to provide a little bit more additional context as the legislator who represents that school district.
Sure.
So I started working with the Phoenix Talent School District probably back in October when we realized the magnitude of what we had experienced when you lose 700 children from your school district and 500 families, and you don't know how the community is going to stabilize and how children and when families are going to be able to return to the community. We realized that this could be a disaster for school district budgets over the next several years. And we started working to try to craft the bill that you see in front of us. This is in the context of a school district that stepped up the minute after the Alameda fire destroyed 2,500 homes. You heard them describe how they tracked all the families. Within days, the school district had set up operations at the Expo emergency site, because I was there most of that first week, and they were there too within 3 or 4 days to provide familiarity for kids, to provide stabilization, to hand out basic supplies, to try to provide some respite for kids for a few minutes while their families were off taking care of other kinds of issues that were connected to the emergency. Immediately after that, they set up operations in White City, which is across the county. It's probably 40 minutes from the school district, but it was necessary because many of our families had fled to stay with families or friends in White City. They started a fund for support, raised over $1 million that was handed out directly to children and families for direct hands-on support with no overhead. They matched families with donated recreation vehicles. Somebody I know donated a great car with 50,000 miles, and the school district helped me find the right family to match with that car. And we matched it with a family where the dad is a farm worker, mom cleans houses, two kids in schools, everybody speaks Spanish. And the school district knew where to find that family and how appreciative they would be. Once school started, they're running a bus route around the Rogue Valley. They're picking up 250 kids wherever they are, whether they are in hotels or whether they are staying with family members or whether they are camping out in a van someplace, and they're bringing them in so that they can have just a little modicum of stability in their lives in the middle of an ongoing crisis. And please note that everybody in the school district, and I believe this is probably true of the other significantly impacted school districts, every child was traumatized by this experience. Not every child lost their home, but virtually every kid who was home on September 8th had to flee at the sight of huge flames coming toward their neighborhood. Some neighborhoods were spared, but all of the kids carry that with them, and many of the teachers do as well. And children who kept their homes have had playmates who have disappeared from their community, from their neighborhood, from their classroom, because families were forced to flee. So let me just say, this is not the moment for us to undermine any of the support that we have for these districts, which are struggling so valiantly to respond to the crisis and to carry on the best they can with an environment that is full of sadness and difficulty and trauma, and they're providing joyful experiences for kids. And I do want to push back on that idea that all we should do is their basic funding and they shouldn't get their a retroactive share of the Student Success Act funding. I mean, we passed that, considering it part and parcel really of a basic package of funding that goes out to our school districts. So to say that we should be able to give these school districts core funding, but hold back on the special stuff that actually funds particular programs and particular enrichment and special supports at a time when you have kids who need so many supports, I think is really misspoken. And finally, I just wanna say, thank you for letting me get this all off my chest, Chair Nathanson, that this is an issue not only for these school districts, this is an issue for the economic development of these communities. Talent and Phoenix, as examples in my backyard, have been destroyed. And those communities, in order for them to build back up, need a school district that is functioning, that is capable. As families look toward the community and make a decision, they need to have confidence in their school district, that their school district is going to be there, is not going to be undermined because of the challenges that they face, that they're going to have a school district that's going to come out of this as strong and capable as ever. And that's what we are trying to do with House Bill 2630. This is not charity. This is really just trying to help these school districts step up for their communities. So thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Representative Marsh. We have completed the witness list. I want to confirm with Manny that we did get to all the names. The last person to sign up was Bob Estabrook. There was no other name after that. Is that correct?
Correct. That was everyone on the list.
Thank you. Committee, any questions for anyone else of the witnesses who are still with us? I don't see any. LRO, do you have any comments for us about the bill or the testimony before I close this public hearing? Okay.
No, Madam Chair.
I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2630. Mr. Alanak, any other comments for us before we adjourn for the afternoon?
Not regarding today's meeting, just a reminder about tomorrow's start time, which will be shifted to 1:30 due to the House floor schedule. We will be sending out notifications and so forth, but while you're all here, or at least most of you.
Yeah, good. Thank you. That's it for today. I'll see y'all tomorrow. We're adjourned.